Welcome to the Drop Podcast of Mid-Atlantic Wiffle Ball. I am Nick Schaefer, and tonight I'm joined by the Cook brothers and former Stomper teammates, Tim and Paul Cook. Today we have a special edition podcast that will feature a new format. We will have a discussion on pitching, and it's going to be called Three Strikes, where each strike will feature a discussion on a pitcher or on pitching. But here's the catch. Tonight we will be transporting you back to the past, where we're going to discuss players and pitchers from the past. So let's jump into it. Tim is going to take strike one, Paul takes strike two, and selfishly, I'm going to take strike three since I was the pitcher of the group. So Tim, why don't you go get us started?
All right, so my pick is Dan Cryan of Team Trenton and the Lakeside Kings. We were lucky enough, we faced him, at least the Stompers did, in 1999. And then, Nick, when you were with us in 2002, we faced him again. And that one, that was a pretty good moment for the second tournament of the year, because you went yard. You went yard on him. So, you know, what I really see from Cryan, and what I really like, especially getting to face him in the box, he had a huge sweeping slider. Like, yeah. You know that Jimmy Cole slider that we had from the Ridley Park tournament? You know, he threw that a ton. He had elite velocity. I remember in 1999, I was like, I don't even know how I'm supposed to get my swing started. And like, he was very much, when we talked to Jerome Coyle back in 2017, you know, when asked, you know, who are the top pitchers, you know, one was Darren Bone, but two was Cryan for Coyle. And, you know, I think that speaks well because, you know, Coyle didn't let just anyone out there.
If Coyle puts you over, you know it's sincere. He was very reserved with his praise. But, yeah, I mean, Cryan, like you said, Tim, when we faced him in 1999, I don't think we'd ever seen a pitcher like that before.
Yeah.
No, we never saw, like, yeah, that velocity. And I think we – did we hit him?
We did. We got runs in both of those games against the Kings and the long shots. I think you were – so who did you – I think you did off of
Cryan. I think I hit the home run off of Cryan, yeah.
Did he also play with Saul, Saul's teammate, a couple of times?
So, yeah, so Cryan's wiffle ball sort of – His team lineage is, in 1991, he played in the league in Trent in the NJWA league, because at that time they had a league and a tournament. And he went to Rick Feroli's tournament in Boston as part of, I think, the Confederate Knights was the name of the team. So then the next year, same thing, he played in the league and he played in the tournament. And he joined another team from Trenton that had also gone to the Boston tournament in 1991, called Good Times Tavern. So they went in in 1992 on that team. Then and Saltez was there for the first time in 1992. He was on a different team, the Trenton Milkmen. So in 1995, all those Trenton teams sort of combined into a super team. So you got Team Trenton, which was Palanzar, Bastido, Cryan, and Saltez. They played together for 3 or 4 years on Team Trenton. And then, yeah, Saltez and Cryan both joined Lakeside Kings at one point. Cryan came first, right, to Kings, Tim?
Yeah, Cryan came early, but he was also he'd show up missing on, you know, the different tournaments. You didn't know if he was you just never knew if he was going to be there, and that kind of like kept going.
But so to answer your question, Nick, they both, him and Saul, played together both on
for you two. Yeah, like, who was, when they both were in their prime, like, who would you say is their ace, or were they like sort of co-ace?
I was just gonna say, I think it's a toss-up.
Yeah, I mean, like, Salt pitched a lot more, or at least a lot more on tape back then. But, yeah, I mean, it really is a toss. I think Cryan, you know, wasn't a one pitch pitcher. I think Salt really, really relied on his drop pitch as like his, you know, go to.
Yeah.
I always thought Salt, I mean, this is not a discussion on Salt, but I always thought Salt was like Mariano Rivera, where Rivera threw the cutter, you knew it was coming, you still couldn't do anything with it. Salt threw the drop screwball, you knew it was coming, and you still couldn't do anything with it. So I always thought they were similar. But back to Crying, so when we faced him, guys, like 8 or 9 years into his career, you know, he was still in the upper echelon of pitchers, but he wasn't like maybe 100% fresh arm. So he was still elite even when we saw him in, you know, 99, 2000, or whatever years it was. So that's pretty impressive for him to have that extensive of a career as an ace.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. We faced him in 2002, the tournament that Tim was talking about earlier, in a championship game. And that was a Lakeside Kings team that had had Lou Worthington, had Salt, and, you know, they were with Crying in that championship game against us. And that's 2002. That's 11 years into his career. So, I mean, he had longevity.
Did he let up the walk-off?
He did, yeah. I think so. Right, Nick? I mean, you hit it.
is that what I threw? I launched the bat 50 feet up in the air?
Yeah, I know, showboat.
I think, well, those home runs were few and far between, so when I did get them, I wanted to act like I was, you know, like a Japanese baseball player.
You don't have to tell me. Next one I hit, I'm gonna take a 2-minute home run try.
Yeah. Question for you two. So we're pretending I hit a home run off of Melissa, or we think I did. Did you two guys, how did you feel in the box? I know Tim said that sometimes you had to start your swing early, but do you guys remember having any success at all?
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, I think I hit a home run off of him in 99. I don't remember any of that 2002 game other than, you know, we needed to walk it off in the sixth inning because there wasn't I guess because we were down. But no, I don't have any, like, real memories other than, yeah, that slider just moved a ton. And, you know, if you could sit on it, but, you know, because it was coming at such velocity and because we had, you know, pretty primitive bats, it wasn't as easy to, you know, even make contact, nonetheless barrel the ball up.
Yeah, I never felt comfortable against him, but that's not unusual for me.
Tim, was your home run at right center?
No, I think it was actually, like, pretty straight away. I mean, I just, you know.
That's my recollection. I think, like, straight away center.
And, you know, and Palinsar's fields being 75 degrees, straight away center is closer than left or right. So, a little power there, but not much.
So, Tim, since you chose Crying, who would be his comp in today's wiffle ball game? What pitcher?
There's a right answer here, Tim.
I know there is, and that answer is Frankie Campanelli.
No, I mean, yeah, pitch selection wise, that's I can see that. But go ahead.
But that wasn't the person you guys were thinking, or Paul, you were thinking.
No, that's not who I'm thinking of.
Who do you think, Paul?
So I think me and you, Nick, mentioned this on a broadcast last year, doing a game. I think Ray Lutick. I
know that's a good idea.
But just the build and that bulldog mentality, you know, he has that Crying essence.
Yeah, and also his compact, I think, motion, because Dan Crying had a baseball-like, and Ray plays baseball, but Dan had a baseball-like motion that was thick frame coming at you. And I wonder if Crying played baseball, high school and or college or whatnot. That'd be interesting to know. Quick side note, I think for all these players, if we have any stories we should share too, wasn't Crying's nickname Crime Dog?
Go ahead.
So my first wiffle ball team before I joined In the Box and then eventually my long career with the Stompers was just me and a college buddy, just a two-man team, and I was very arrogant, as you guys can imagine back then, thinking, yeah, no, none of my friends hit me, none of my college buddies hit me when I pitch. So I played on a team called the Salt Dogs, and the name was intentionally making fun of Mike Saltez and Dan Crying, because I read their information off of the old Wiffle Ball USA website, who had Mike Palinsar had a message board on there, and I'm telling people I'm going to dominate the tournament. I showed up. We went 0-3. and then we showed up to Brewster, and we went 1-2. And then I remember somebody rolled the ball. I think it was Jay from State of Mind rolled the ball to me. He goes, "Can you sign this for me, Hollywood?" So, but anyway, I remember intentionally choosing our first team's name ever, making fun of in a funny way, Mike Saltez and Dan Cryan. We called ourselves the Salt Dogs. So that's just a side note that I thought was, looking back as I mature, that's kind of embarrassing.
Oh, yeah, also no, kind of it's a, you know, different time periods. You do different stuff.
Yeah. Those old message boards, that was some good times on...
There could be some good times, but man, especially those message boards, they were the wiffle burner accounts of today.
So, let's one more question on Cryan before we move on to strike two. Tim or Paul, let's go to Tim first, I guess. How would Cryan do in today's wiffle ball game? Do you see him being an ace? Where do you kind of think
See him as a guy who is going to give you one great game. So, you need to figure out where to use that. He's you know, longevity wise, and I mean, this is how he was at least from 98 to 2002. You know, he's just not going to have, he's not going to be able to go back to back to back. And yeah, I really see him as like, I'm going to give you one awesome game, but then I'm done.
And I lied. I have one more question. I'll let Paul take this. Paul, since this is a historical perspective special podcast tonight, where do you see Cryan fitting historically? And let's not compare him to today's pitchers, actually. Let's say when he retired, whenever that was, where do you think he fell as a pitcher historically? Was he top 20? Was he top 10 and of his generation, top 5 even? What do you think?
So, I mean, like, if you define his era, I think his sort of prime would have been, 95 through, 2000, somewhere around there. I think during that prime, he was easily top 5. It was him, Salt, Chris Bechtold a little bit, Billy Owens. I don't know when Dan stopped playing, but I think he would have been a pretty easy Hall of Fame pick if there was an established Hall of Fame at that point. I think he checks a lot of the boxes. He had good national championship runs in Boston. He had the three national championship runs where he was a big part of that team in Team Trenton when they won the three Cincinnati ones. To me, he's a Hall of Famer.
Awesome. All right, so good stuff there on Dan Cryan. Good choice, Tim. Let's move on to strike two. So, Paul, what pitcher do you have?
All right, so I'm going to go, I don't know if it's obscure or not, but it's one of my favorites. So I'm going to go with someone that we met at our very first tournament, and that's Matt Weller of the Shamokin Short Busters. Did you play in Shamokin, right, in 2001, Nick?
I did, but I didn't play them, so I don't have much personal knowledge of facing him. But I know of him.
Right. So that was his tournament, the Shamokin tournament. So that was our first one, mine and Tim's first tournament in 1998 with Shamokin, and we went there all 4 years. The reason I chose Mad, I've been thinking about him for different reasons recently, but the real reason I chose him is sort of when I think of, and let me know if you agree on this, Tim, when I think of 1998 wiffle ball and I think of like the pitching style, I think Matt Weller encapsulates that more than anyone.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely tried to repeat his motion and stuff. He's the guy who's going to come with a riser and throw it as hard as he can, and sometimes he's going to be on, but if he's not on, it's not going to be good either.
And describe his arm angle.
So, I mean, I think he came from, I mean, way a little lower than 3-4.
Way down,
and he did holes down and just, like, let go 2 or 3 feet ahead. Like, it wasn't a sturdy motion at all. And, so the ball got on you pretty fast, but, thrown into those strike zones, still was not easy. And, like, he had good games, but he had bad games, too.
So,
what did he feature on the mound, Paul? What kind of pitches did he throw? I know you talked about his motion a little.
So he was heavy riser and heavy submarine riser. So, like, when I'm saying submarine, like, I don't even think I don't even think there's a pitcher that goes, you know, as far down today, at least that, you know, that I'm aware of, as Matt did back in the day.
No, there's not.
Like, maybe Colin kind of gets the closest, you know, and he doesn't go, you know, that far down. So like way submarine, Darren O'Day type submarine motion, and it was a riser. So let me read you, speaking of that, let me read you a part of his bio here from the Shamokin. So he's on the Shamokin Short Busters team from their website back in the day. Matt has a unique riser that not only rises up, but comes in on the batter as well. So yeah, so he had this, and I think that's pretty accurate. He had this riser that had a lot of vertical movement, but yeah, it also had a little bit of a cut to it. The problem with it is that, like Tim said, it was very, very wild. I think trying to repeat that motion was so hard. But that's what I remember. That's what I remember, like, really being sort of the pitching style of the day. At least that's what the guys that really tried to emulate the guys that they saw at tournaments, they all sort of did that real submarine, you know, riser type of thing. We had a teammate that tried that. And yeah, it was such a weird arm angle that it worked well, but like it's such a hard motion to repeat. So like, you know, Jordan will kind of go down a little bit on a riser. Like when Jordan does it, it's kind of, or actually here's a better example. Think of like Lou Worthington. So like when he throws his, he went real under, you know, underhand with it, but he kind of just dropped his arm. Like he still sort of did like a normal motion. The way Matt did it was like he tilted his whole, the first movement in the motion was to tilt his whole body downwards rather than just drop his arm. So like you've got this really awkward motion that like it's not a softball motion. No one else does it, and it's just so hard to repeat. And I think that was his downfall. But he stands out to me just because like so many guys were trying to do that back in the day. To me, he's like the prototypical 1998 pitcher.
So, Paul, would you say he's one of the more unique pitchers you ever seen on the mound?
Sort of, but, you know, like I said, I think a lot of guys were trying to do that back then. So, to me, he sort of just encapsulates that era, and I think it was a short, yeah, I don't even know if you want to call it an era, it was a short thing, but if you saw him now, you would say he's totally unique. And even if you saw him 15 years ago, you would say he was unique. He was just sort of, it was that short time period of like 1998, 1999, where I think his style was kind of in vogue. And I think it went out of vogue because, you know, who the heck could command a pitch like that? But
he really violently threw his arm down too. And it was, yeah.
It's tough to describe.
Yeah. Is he like
Randy Myers, but righty? Remember how Randy Myers went all the way to the left and down and threw a sidearm curveball?
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, it was the amount of effort he did to, you know, holes were down, so he's throwing a riser. So he's, you know, as he's coming through, it looks like he's going to throw it right into the ground. But he's, because he's coming from the side enough, it gives him that natural cut. And, you know, thus, when it was working, that riser was, you know, top 10 in the game.
And did either one of you guys face him before, and how'd you do?
So we both faced him and played with him. We faced him in we didn't face him in our second game ever. We faced his team, but he didn't pitch. But, yeah, we faced him sometimes. I can't remember, like, the exact games. We definitely faced him at least once. Would you agree, Tim? Or did we not, maybe?
No, we did. I mean, I think 98 and 99. And maybe...
Okay.
And
we may have. And if we did, I think the odds are that we took a lot of walks against him because he didn't have that command. But we got to play with him in the summer showdown in both 1999 and 2000. So Tim was mentioning the 1999 summer showdown with Dan Cry, and when we faced him, so we faced the Kings and the Long Shots in that tournament. So two good teams.
Wow!
And Matt pitched against him. He kept us in the game. Like, you know, it was really, if you threw it over, we would have won those games because we scored some runs. We scored at least three or four off of both of the teams. But he's a great guy too. Just like a really, you know, he was in his mid-20s at that point probably. You know, me, Tim, and Dan were like 14, 15, 16, 17 in that age group.
Yeah.
But just, you know, really made us feel welcomed. He was a really great guy. He's, I think a lot of pitchers, you know, have this background. He was a big-time wrestler in high school, and then he was coaching wrestling at that point in high school. I know, like, you know, Jordan has that background, Dan Haverty has that background. I know there's some others.
Yeah.
And he was kind of built like that too. You know, he had the broad shoulders, the strong legs, and like, even though he wasn't throwing the ball over, he could pitch for you all day. You know, it didn't matter at some point because he wasn't throwing the ball over all the time. But you know, he was a workhorse. He could never find that, you know, command, that consistent release point.
You know who else had that background of wrestling / baseball? Who? Macho Man Randy Savage.
That's right. Yeah, he's a Reds prospect at one point.
Yeah. So here's Shamokin brings back a lot of memories for me, because it was it might have been my first tournament I officially played with in the box, and I clearly remember this all the time when I'm driving down 476 in Pennsylvania. But it was downpouring my whole drive there. I was driving at night. Uh-huh. Meeting the Lucasio brothers, Tom and Frank, and I got to the hotel. I'm staying with them, and not knowing that Frank was going to snore like a walrus in the place, and Tom warned me of it, the room would shake. I remember it was so hard for me to fall asleep, because A, I was so pumped up to show them that I was worth it to be in the box, and B, the room was shaking with Frank snoring. And then I remember the next day, we all had to get up early, and you guys probably remember this a lot. For those of you that are playing the modern game, back then we used to have to get there like two, 3 hours early, set up these outfield fences that weighed like 50 pounds or more. Yeah. Each, and would cut your hands up. And by the time the game started, you were halfway worn out for the day. And Ledge used to drive these things over from, you know, wherever he was coming from. And it was a crazy day, but it was a good bonding time before the tournament even started. But that's some of my first, and I actually think we might have finished first that tournament. I can't remember if it was us or the Kings, but you know, in that Shamokin tournament.
Yeah, I think you guys did. You definitely made the finals. And yeah, Shamokin was always a great time. I mean, me and Tim have real fond memories of that. I mean, like I said, that was our first tournament. We went there 4 years in a row. And, you know, I know we're talking about pitching, but, you know, Matt was the whole driving force behind that tournament too. And it was just, you know, it was a really cool time.
So next time you're driving in Pennsylvania on the Turnpike, you'll see the Shamokin exit. It'll bring back some great memories. But, anything else you want to add on him?
Yeah, no, that was pretty much it.
All right, so let's go to the strikeout. Strike three, I choose, and I spoke about this pitcher briefly, probably like 6 months ago, for, you know, about 10 seconds on one of our old podcasts, but Nick Torella from the Rhode Island Kings, and I think he also might have played for the Blue Sox, but he's known from the Rhode Island Kings. Yeah, he did, right? Yeah. And part of the reason why I chose Nick is I think he was one of the elite power pitchers to the game. But what I always remember him by is he was like the first to consistently break out the changeup, and people would just, their knees would buckle. They were unable to even swing the bat most of the time he threw a changeup. And I think Nick was totally ahead of his time. When Paul and I do our broadcast of the games, whenever people throw changeups, I'm like, it always brings back, you know, flashbacks, bad flashbacks, PTSD, watching Nick pitch, because I struck out a bunch against Nick. Most of it was when I played for the box. We had some battles with them. But, you know, Nick was an awesome, awesome pitcher. And he's sort of like Matt, too. I guess he helped run tournaments and maybe they're even the region or when we had the tournament in Rhode Island. But I remember one story, though, Paul and Tim, is I got a good tip. It didn't help me, but it helped the team. One day Frank hits a home run off his changeup. Tom goes, Frank, how'd you hit that? How'd you know it was coming? He goes, I just sit on changeup. If there's a fastball, I'm not going to hit it anyway. So Frank used to strike out, look at her, sit on the changeup. So I sat on a changeup. And of course, Nick is like, I'm not going to throw this guy a changeup. I wasn't that good hitting back then. He's like, so I never got a changeup really versus him. So Frank's advice was wrong for me, but good for Bruce and Tom. But, you know, did you guys ever face Nick, and what'd you think?
So So we faced the Rhode Island Kings, Tim, in Shamokin in 2001 when we made our first Final Eight. Did he pitch or did Washington pitch?
I think Washington
was another
pitched.
Good pitcher too.
Okay, so yeah, when we
talk about arm, Washington had a great
the
arm
tournament,
too.
So I go ahead.
The tournament in 2001, that was the rainy day where we lost 1-0 to Kevin Alvine and 1-0 to the Kings. I think he pitched that game.
Okay, so that was either New York or Bruce's tournament in Rhode Island. Because you were, yeah, Ossining, New York, or Rhode Island. Yeah, I think you're right. But my Knicks story, and I'm not even sure this is, he probably didn't pitch this tournament, but like, it was either 2001 or 2002. It was one of those USPPBA tournaments. Nick had a cast on his, like, I think it was his right arm, so he probably, obviously, he probably didn't pitch. Still played the tournament. It just, he kind of rested his other arm, you know, the cast arm against the bat, you know, and still swung. He was swinging a yellow bat, which was, you know, he normally didn't swing, but, you know, he was just trying to get around. And then my recollection is he got some hits.
Yeah, I do remember that now. That was crazy.
And the other story that comes to mind from him is he's partially responsible, I think, for giving Kenny Rogers Sr. Moonlight his nickname. I think Tom Ocasio posted this on Facebook within the last, like, I don't know, 12, 18 months, that the story was, you know, because Tom has a reputation now, and he even had it back in the day of being, he found you, Nick, like, you know, he found Joe Nord, yeah. he found Moonlight, he found the Walshes, as a good scout, so, like, he would always sort of find these guys out of nowhere, so, like, they were at some tournament.
Joe Nord,
yeah. So, yeah. In the box was at some tournament, and the Rhode Island Kings were there, so Nick Turilli was there, you know, they were standing around before the tournament, and it was just Frank and Tom, and Nick goes, you know, do you have anyone else? And, you know, this Moonlight starts walking up, and, you know, Tom goes, yeah, him. You know, so Nick goes, you know, where do you find these guys? And you just pick them up on the side of the road. So, you know, so then referencing, you know, Field of Dreams of picking up Moonlight Graham, that became his nickname. At least that's, I'm pretty awesome. Sure I read that story somewhere.
Yeah, I do remember that. And speaking of stories, I looked this up the other day when I knew I was going to pick Nick as my guy, and it's from an old article from, I think it's from like 2000 or whatever, from a newspaper called the Quad City Times. Uh-huh. And Nick is quoted in this, and it says, in one tournament this summer, Torella threw 30 innings and struck out 85 batters and only gave up one run. And here's his quote, guys, and I think this is so Nick. Quote, my stuff is so sick, Torella says, it's unhittable. And I like, sometimes you think, okay, you know, he's a little cocky or whatever, but when you could back it up with that elite fastball, I'm talking about, you know, top-notch fastball and top-notch changeup, like sort of like Johan Santana, yeah. You know, but righty, you know, that quote is actually being modest.
No, and like you said, that was just so him. Like, he sort of had that, you know, I don't want to insult anyone, but he sort of had that Guido sort of personality. You know what I mean? He was like a Paulie D type guy. But he's a nice guy too. Like that's just how he was. It was just confident and whatever. But like, yeah, I mean, as teenagers, Tim, I think he, you know, intimidated the heck out of us. Cause he had that confidence and that drive.
Yeah. And I mean, he's another one who he threw fast and like fast and hard and yeah. You know, little time to, you know, get your bat moving.
And who would you guys comp him as? Like I immediately think Loftus and Wittner as two people because they have elite fastballs and good changeups too. Maybe Wittner a little bit ahead in changeup, but who would you guys comp him as for today's game?
I like both of those comps because he was kind of built a little similarly you know, at least kind of like those guys where, you know, both Dan and Tommy aren't the biggest guys, but they generate power by their, you know, just by their mechanics and by, you know, just, yeah, by their mechanics and by their leg strength. I think Nick had a little more violence of a delivery, if I recall, than either of those guys. But yeah, I think those are pretty good comps. What did he throw, Nick?
I mean, he threw riser, screwball. I don't know if a screwball was a pure screwball or screw drop. And then he actually threw a hard straight pitch too, which back then wasn't like unheard of. But his straight pitch was like coming a little bit overhand, so it was hard to get your bat on top of it. You were mostly underneath it because it was hitting a high part of the strike zone.
And the change played off.
Yeah, and his changeup was almost the same arm angle and. That's the key to change up in Major League Baseball, and sometimes wiffle ball doesn't have to be, but it still helps because you think a fastball is coming and the ball is 40 miles per hour slower. So I don't remember everything he threw. I'm sure he threw a riser and stuff, but one thing I was going to say to you guys, I don't know what you think, is there's two pitchers, and Nick's one of them, obviously, that I always feel were hard done by, you know, with their luck of not winning, like, championships. Nick did win some tournaments, obviously, because his team was loaded with pitching with him at Washington and then when he joined the Blue Sox. But people expected Rhode Island Kings or Blue Sox to win the national championship, and they always fell short. And then the other pitcher I'm thinking is Elvin Cortez. I feel like both of them are grouped together that kind of just fell short of their talent level. Not necessarily their fault, but I think Nick kind of deserved sort of a little bit more team success than he got.
Yeah, I agree with that. And as you were speaking, I remember that Nick also played with, I think they were called Thunder in like, I want to say 2005-ish, where it was, I can't remember his name right now, I'm sorry, but like, do you remember the lead Blue Sox guy's name, the guy with the glasses?
Yeah, I don't remember his name, but I can remember him. Yeah. He was very good.
I can picture him. So it was him, Nick, Bruce Christie, and I think they probably had someone else. Wow. And, you know, it's like yeah, like that's another good team. They failed to win a championship. But, yeah, I like the Elvin comp because it is sort of the same sort of deal where just, you know, hard-nosed competitors, really good stuff. It just never came together from team-wise. You know, like Elvin.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Paul.
I was just saying, like Elvin, you know, Elvin ended up joining State of Mind.
Yeah.
You know, to try to get onto a different team and try to win that championship. It still didn't work with him. Nick did the same thing, and it just unfortunately never worked out.
Oh, that is true. I mean, but they're both. Nick would be another Hall of Famer in my book too. I think almost no doubt because he had the premier pitch with the changeup for about 4 or 5 years, and a lot of pitchers today could learn a lot if there was video on Nick and any of these players you mentioned crying. There's very little of these guys, and it's a shame because, you know, they were incredible pitchers that people can, you know, try to base some of their own style off of them.
Yeah. My only issue with Nick for the Hall of Fame is I'm not quite sure he had the longevity as, like, a top-notch guy. But, yeah, like, I mean, you know, he's kind of Sandy Koufax-esque where he had, you know, he had 4 or 5, 6 years where he was, you know, a real threat.
He would probably get 70% of the vote, not 75%. All right, do you guys have anything else to add?
No, I'm good, Tim.
Yeah, no, I'm good too. I'll be interesting to hear everybody's version of the hitters when we do that podcast.
Yeah, so what we plan on doing in the future is we plan on having a hitting one called The Cycle, which will have 4 topics of hitting, either hitters or just hitting topics representing the single, double, triple, and home run. So keep an eye out for, or ear out for that podcast coming out. We hope you enjoyed this special edition drop podcast called 3 Strikes. And like I said, keep an eye out for The Cycle. Thanks for joining us again. I'm Nick Schaefer, and I was joined by Tim and Paul Cook. So we'll see you next time.